And now to Thomas Schaffernacker with some weather news. Thomas?
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Well, let's start the weather with the United States, first of all, and trouble brewing on the weather front here, especially across the eastern half of the United States. A storm in the making currently, and this is because cold air all the way from Canada and the Midwest is engaging tropical air from the Gulf and also Florida, and that's created this storm. So that means lots of rain along the entire Atlantic seaboard of the United States, all the way from Georgia, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, in fact, all the way up to Nova Scotia. And that, of course, means that with such a widespread area of bad weather, there could be some disruption to air travel. So, for example, Atlanta Airport, all the way to Dulles Airport, JFK, could be some problems and delays, and also a bumpy ride because a jet stream is associated with this big weather system as well. So lots happening across the eastern half of the United States. Now, as far as the other side of the states is concerned, on the Pacific side in California, well, it's glorious sunshine. In San Francisco, over the next few days, temperatures will be climbing. In fact, by the time we get to Friday in San Fran by the Golden Gate Bridge, around 25 or 26 degrees, again, with lots of sunshine. And of course, at the same time, it's a washout for a time, at least in New York City and Washington, D.C. So that's the United States. Let's head over the pond to Europe, and we have our own little storm across northwestern parts of Europe as well. We've just had a battering of wind and rain across the UK. Currently, France and Germany bearing the brunt of a cold weather front, and that means the temperatures across many central and western parts of Europe will be plummeting as we go over the next couple of days. And here's an example for you. In Switzerland, Zurich, on Tuesday, 18 degrees, Wednesday down to 10 Celsius. By Friday, we're only talking about 5 degrees, and the nights will also be cold across many parts of France, Germany, Switzerland, and even down as far south as northern Italy. All the time, the Mediterranean stays pretty warm. Now, the weather is also going to change as we head towards the end of the week across western parts of Europe. This cold air is going to be replaced by much milder, but also quite turbulent weather as well. We've got another big jet stream developing across the Atlantic as we speak, and by the end of the week, it will be roaring across the North Atlantic, sending more wet and windy weather our way towards Western Europe, but this time it'll be a lot milder. And I think I'll finish off with Asia. Let's have a look at the Asia Pacific region. So Tokyo here, lots of great weather in the coming days. By the end of the week, it does look as though in Japan, things are going to turn a little bit more stormy. Thunderstorms on the way and a dip in the temperature too. How about Shanghai? Wednesday and Thursday, it's looking sunny at around 22 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker for Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomasz. And as I said, you are in Midori House. Our show is called Midori House this hour. I'm Nancy Durham here with Tyler Brulé. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well, too.
Good.
I'm loving being here.
How did you enjoy last evening?
I thought it was great. Oh, well, should we start with the party?
Well, that's what I was saying. Yeah, I wasn't referring to my show last night. You know, I went on afterwards.
I know. I mean, you're just going on and on and on.
On and on and on.
And you look good.
Thanks.
And you're up, and I'm really happy that you're in here. I knew I was going to have a partner
before,
in here. I just didn't know who it was until a very short time ago.
Are you with us for 4 days this week or three?
Three.
Oh, okay.
Because you decided to do that live on air, did you? Yeah.
I just wanted to check.
Okay. No, I'm very happy to be here
Good.
Tonight, Tuesday, my second night. So on with the show. And as you know, today's Midori House, it's B, that stands for business. And so we focus on Monocle Magazine's business section. In the new issue that's out just now, Cairo correspondent Jack Schenker gives us a rich analysis of the business mood in Cairo and a survey of some of the city's most successful entrepreneurs. And lucky us, Jack is with us. Welcome.
Hi.
Welcome to Midori House.
It's an honour to be here. Tyler set the bar very high, so I'm feeling a bit nervous now. I came in fully relaxed, well, and now my heart's pounding.
With my mini chit-chat, Jack? No.
Tyler might want to ask you how long you're going to be here and things like
No, well, listen, the problem with Jack Schenker is I never believe he's actually in Cairo. I think he actually did this all over the phone, because every time we want him, it's like he's around the corner. So, anyway.
He's a very agreeable correspondent. I think
you can say that.
I like to feel I bring a spirit of the Arab Spring to wherever I am,
absolutely.
Be it, you know, Midori House or Finsbury Park where I live, or indeed
Excellent.
Cairo itself.
Well, bring a little bit of Cairo to us. We've all watched and heard so much from there over the past many months. And I don't think we're in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. It seems to continue in various ways, obviously. But, you know, the political climate is uncertain. And I guess we might start by asking you, you know, what is the effect of all of this uncertainty on business and all these entrepreneurs who are in Cairo and Egypt?
Well, it's a great time to be asking the question because just in the past week or so, we've seen renewed violence on the streets of Cairo, the continuation of the political uncertainty, which has really prevailed since former President Hosni Mubarak fell back in February. At the moment, we have this Supreme Council of the Armed Forces ruling the country essentially by diktat. And they've promised to give way to a democratic civilian government in various stages, starting with parliamentary elections next month. The problem is that that timetable has been very fuzzy. There's been a lot of delays. There's been a lot of confusion. And on top of it all, there's been a growing sense, certainly amongst a lot of people on the street, that the military generals who are ruling the country don't really want to cede power. And they're actually trying to stifle kind of genuine revolutionary change. And of course, that kind of uncertainty has a big impact on the business community. Egypt's economic situation is very fragile at the moment. It was already in a lot of trouble before the revolution kicked off on January 25th this year. And obviously, the political upheaval has made the business climate even more difficult. The macroeconomic situation is very challenging. Egypt's got a very high debt. It's struggling with a huge unemployment problem, a demographic bulge where you have 700,000 new graduates chasing 200,000 jobs every year. And it's suffering from a huge amount of poverty as well.
Sounds very pessimistic, yet you managed to find some reasons to smile.
Well, that's probably a character flaw on my part.
There's
a lot of reasons for pessimism, both on the political and economic front. I think that meeting a lot of the entrepreneurs, which you can read about in this month's issue, shows you just how much creativity and energy there is in terms of a predominantly younger generation. It's not only an age thing, but a lot of them do tend to be younger, who are coming up with amazing new ideas and ways to, I guess, break the mold. The problem is that under 3 decades of Mubarak, you had two things. You had, first of all, institutionalized corruption, where it was very difficult for any individuals to rise within the business world without, the Egyptian word is wasta, which means influence and having the right contacts and the right influence. And so that institutionalized corruption, people hope, is now going to be challenged. And also the neoliberal economic consensus, which kept a lot of people poor, is also being challenged. So people see there's a lot of opportunity.
I just wanted to ask, Jack, is it a situation that it was perhaps ever thus? Because you've introduced us to some amazing people. If I look at Hind and Nadia Wassef, for example, will you always have this, you know, entrepreneurial layer? And I sort of wonder, when you sort of can skim along the surface and you're probably doing reasonably well, being, you know, far beyond upper middle class, simply upper class, is that sort of side, you know, of culture in Cairo rather bulletproof? I mean that in an economic way.
To an extent. I mean, if you look at the real economic winners from the Mubarak regime, the people who are dominating business, they weren't the kind of people that you see in this month's magazine. These are guys who are younger and who have had to work really hard through the power of their ideas and the energy they have to make a success of things, because they didn't have those contacts. They weren't the Ahmed, I talk about Ahmed Ez in the piece, who was Egypt's biggest political power broker and also this steel magnate who was one of the richest men in the country. Those are the kind of guys that really won under Mubarak. These guys are now coming through, and certainly, you know, if you're asking, is there a level of kind of business entrepreneurship and kind of energy and passion? Yeah, that's always been there, and it's been there for decades. You know, even under Nasser, with a largely socialist system, you saw a lot of cultural development, a lot of creativity. So that's certainly always going to be there.
Okay, just picking up on Todd, I had my eye on the same two women.
Sorry, beat you to it.
I know, but you didn't tell us who they are. And there's a fantastic stat here, fascinating stat here you've dug up, that the average Egyptian reads a bit of a page of a novel a year. And these two women thought, what the heck, we are going to open a bookstore. So they're thriving, so somebody's reading. But where did you get that stat? And what are they doing if they're not reading?
Well,
they're in traffic jams, I guess.
For half the time, yeah. If you've ever been to Cairo, you know just how frustrating the traffic is. I mean, the statistics that's bandied around is that it's a quarter of a page of a novel per year, per Egyptian. But in a country of 80 million people where the illiteracy rate is very high, that's perhaps no surprise. Of course, Egypt is also, in other respects, a very educated country with a high proportion of university graduates and, you know, some of the region's leading intellectuals. So it's not as if nobody's buying books. I mean, I think what Hind and Nadia picked up on was a demand for book retailing to move in a different direction, rather than these musty old shops with dusty volumes piled high to the ceiling and, you know, completely unnavigable.
They wanted to bring a cup of cappuccino into the
absolutely
salon.
Make it an all-round experience of sitting down, lounging on a sofa, picking up your favourite volume and novel. And they've been very successful in that, and there's been lots of copycats since.
Has there been a Barnes & Noble Borders style? Well, Borders is gone now, but the mega bookstore, has that actually started to plague the streets or malls of Egypt?
No. The closest thing you have is Diwans, but they've only got 9 stores across the country. One of the things they found, and one of the things they complained to me about, is that although they feel they've been very innovative, they've expanded the market and they've drawn a lot of people into reading books, they feel that other retailers are just trying to copy their style rather than expanding the market further. So they're saying, where is the great academic textbook store? Where is the fantastic cultural heritage bookstore? You know, there are all these niche markets that people could be exploring, but instead, they've seen Diwan's success and tried to jump on the back of it. So there's still a lot of potential for growth in that industry. Mm.
With this, you know, ongoing kind of dire economic situation and the political uncertainty, I'm always interested to know, what are the people talking about? Like, because people tend to sort of keep talking about the same things. Are they all worried about the economy, or are they concerned about the uncertainty and insecurity and not knowing what will happen after the election?
Well, all those things are interlinked, and you know, people's primary starting point is their own position and their own job security and the welfare of their family. And a lot of people have really been suffering in the last few months. And of course, they were suffering before the revolution as well. You know, 9 out of 10 people in Egypt have got poorer in real terms in the last 20 years. When you add all the political upheaval and the fact that there are, with some alarming irregularity, clashes in the streets, reports of the army opening fire on peaceful protesters, that creates a lot of insecurity. But yet, even the latest polling shows that Egyptians remain optimistic that things will get better, that although this transition is going to be very bumpy and take time, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that optimism actually shines out if you read these business figures here. You know, they really express that.
They're engagingly random, aren't they? Little examples of, you know, Egypt, what is it? Egyptian gourmet. You've got the
absolutely
food.
Gourmet Egypt.
Yeah,
yes.
Gourmet Egypt. Yeah. Now, does that guy go around with a motorcycle and deliver things, or is that the way it used to be?
That's the way it used to be. They still have delivery guys, but when they first started out, they basically had one guy with an icebox strapped to the back of a beat-up old Chinese motorbike, and they were sending out some of the world's most premium ingredients to random apartments and hotels in Cairo. They've tapped into a growing trend, obviously above, within the upper middle class and upper class, for far more premium ingredients. And you can see in a lot of these examples, you know, rather unlikely sources of entrepreneurship. I mean, there's also a cooking school we feature where they believe that Egyptian cuisine is about to have this great renaissance, and people and tourists and Egyptians are going to want to learn about their culinary heritage. And you go all the way from that to guys who are doing tech and social media startups. So across the board, you've got a lot of energy. They're just waiting for some kind of economic certainty and some policy certainty to know how these ideas are actually going to play out in the future.
Do you share the optimism that you've been describing? Or
I do, to a certain extent. I think that if you read the news from Egypt from the past few weeks, it's been unremittingly grim. But I think the fact that Egyptians mobilized in such large numbers and overcame a psychological fear barrier to bring down a dictator, that's something very hard to reverse. And although progress isn't going to be linear, and we're going to see setbacks and we're going to see violence and the economic climate is going to go up and down, I think in the long term, Egyptians are at a point of no return, whereby they are mobilizing for a better country, they are mobilizing for a better future. And the ruling elites, who, you know, are very much still part of the old regime, are aware of that. And there's troubled times ahead, but I am optimistic.
I like your quip about Ahmed as that steel baron who's now doing his time in jail. What has he got? 10 years.
Yes.
But I gather people are still talking about him because you've got somebody saying we should have a monument to him because we hated him so much he got us into the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and it's the same with a lot of former regime figures. You know, a lot of these figures very much wined and dined by Western policymakers and Western businessmen at the time. They're now in jail paying multi-million pound fines and facing sort of 10, 20 year prison sentences. Ahmed Ez was a primary example of how the elite in the political and business worlds became completely blurred. You know, if you were successful in one, you were successful in the other. The top parliamentarians and members of the ruling party were all top businesses as well. And, you know, if you were a top businessman, you naturally moved into politics. And Ahmed Ez was just the icing on the cake of that. And he certainly motivated a lot of opposition.
Jack Shenker, our Cairo correspondent, thank you so much for being here with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 2525 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Nancy Durham here with Tyler Brûlé on Midori House. Now, this month's Monocle magazine really pushes the boat out on food. Our international team of correspondents has scoured the food shelves of the world from the tiniest artisanal shops to ambitious supermarkets in search of the best. Santiago Tarditi is the lucky Monocle man who snagged the job of chief food journo. He brought us this solar food treat from the Helsinki waterfront.
There's still some years to wait before Helsinki's fish harbour relaunches as a residential hotspot. But one of its parking lots was the home this summer of an early adopter, Anto Mesmanieni, and his solar kitchen. Highlighted by the Kalasatama skyline, the rock star turned chef's travelling roadshow visited for 2 weeks, serving food that was cooked with nothing else than panels that reflected the heat of the sun. Using solar energy is not just an amusing innovation. It lets Anto extract flavours. The shiny machines, built by Spanish renewable energy specialists, heat the ingredients at a uniform temperature, challenging the chefs to rethink their recipes from the ground up. The flip side is that the guests need to embrace the challenge too. The steak you ordered could be reinvented as sashimi salad if the sky clouds over. And a dish that cooks in minutes at noontime can take half an hour in the evening.
For me, it's a curiosity about things around food that drives me. I think there should be more brave chefs or more radical people to do new kind of concepts.
The key to doing well as a restaurant is usually the promise of a reliable night out. But the solar kitchen takes the opposite approach and asks its guests to expect the unexpected, or at least take a careful look at the weather forecast before ordering.
Santiago Tarditi is with us, of course, and how did it taste? It sounded really good.
Hi, Nancy. Yeah, in fact, it was very good. I think we were lucky because it was a very sunny day.
So things were actually cooked properly.
Yeah, they were working.
I was going to say, which is a bit of a challenge, you know, in Helsinki, even in the height of summer. I mean, you know what it could be like. Nancy, I've often sort of complained, you know what the north side of the Baltic is like.
Yeah.
You can be sort of 10 degrees all summer and grey.
But in the pretty video pictures that went with that scene you created, those dishes looked like those solar dishes, beautiful sort of silver cups. I guess they were aluminium or aluminum, depending on where you live. And they get very, very hot.
In fact, they were very hot, yes. I put my hand over one of the pots, and you could actually burn yourself if you touch it.
They should have had a sign for you then.
Don't touch.
sit and eat.
What did you eat?
We tried a Finnish take on English breakfast. So there were like beans and there were some local cheeses. He also managed to do scrambled eggs, which I have to say were lukewarm.
Yeah, not the best thing perhaps.
I think, why try to redo the English breakfast? That's my first question. I'd be happier with the Finnish breakfast, wouldn't you?
I think I might be.
Yeah.
I think I'd prefer that. And speaking of an English breakfast, why don't we traverse the globe and come to London to Borough Market, which is one of my favorite places. And I was amazed to read in your story, in your reporting in this edition, this issue, that it's been there since 1755. And we just take it for granted. Granted, don't we, I think, somehow. Special place.
Yeah, it is a very special place. I was there this weekend again, and it was packed, full of tourists. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's a new market coming up less than a mile away. And between the streets of Maltby, Druid, and Stanworth. And these are basically some merchants who set up shop in empty railway arches in the Bermondsey area. And they're selling all type of products, wonderful products. For example, I had a very nice bread from St. John's Bakery. Topolsky sells polished, smoked, and cured meats. And the Colonel Brewery has very nice beers, too.
Why do you think that they went for this satellite approach? Is it a cost issue that maybe Borough Market's priced itself out of the market? Or even that they would just want to be more part of just another emerging neighborhood? Just any sort of read? What were they saying?
Well, actually, it started with two of the main traders, the Monmouth Coffee Company and the Neil's Yard Dairy, who were looking for a place to store all their produce. And they saw that they could sell on Saturday mornings. And slowly they attracted other traders, other merchants who thought it was a great and inexpensive place to go to. And now it's becoming a hotspot for foodies in London.
What's it called?
Sorry?
This satellite place, what's it called or going to be called?
They don't have like an official name now, but some people know it as Maltby Street Market. But as I said, it's all... Some of the shops are also on Druid Street or in Stanworth Street. So.
Sounds like a branding project.
Yeah, I think I'll get on that.
Yeah.
Because I'm becoming...
I'll get on it first.
Oh, yeah, okay, thanks. Can I help?
You can go set up your stall, but I'll do the branding.
I'm working on another part of the globe. Now, do you want to go someplace next? Because I've got my eye all over... Santiago's been all over the place.
Sure.
And I want to taste all those foods, but what have
I just want to do a shameless plug for your products, because there's a lot of early mornings. You know that Nancy has a beautiful collection, right?
Yeah.
You meant a beautiful clay.
Of?
Yes. Nancy has a beautiful collection of products, which she develops on her lavender farm. And maybe you have other labs as well for development. But I was thinking, because there's so many early starts, and I mean, people are in here at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we've only had one day of two days now of good-looking guests. But we've introduced toothbrushes now.
Creams.
Yes, exactly.
Lavender creams.
Toothbrushes. We have early morning, it's all day mouthwash now. But I think we need creams in the bathrooms.
I would love to supply.
But small sachets, like tiny ones.
Single use. A cream
single
wouldn't
use.
Come in a sachet. It would have to come in a little pot, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
a tiny pot.
Or a dispenser or something.
Yeah, we could even like have it pumped. No, but then people get piggy.
Just
if you
give them
a
nice little sample, I think.
Yeah, anyway, just that's
okay,
just
well, I've
got to
go now and work on this.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you want to choose the next place?
No. Nope.
It's a smorgasbord.
It's your show. It's in your contract. There was like literally four pages
and I've
about
got to,
this.
Look at the time. Sao Paulo, I do want to drive up to this, what's it called? Emporio Santa Maria. Valet parking, sommeliers inside. Everything you'd possibly want to eat or drink is available there.
And 150 different types of olive oil alone.
Have you been?
No, I haven't been there, unfortunately. I think we should organize a trip there.
No, I've been.
And with us now is Tyler Brulé. Yeah.
Because these are Santiago's pages, but I've only heard about this place, and I went there, and the best bit, I don't know if we have a picture of the boxes. Do we have a picture of the boxes?
You mean the boxes that
The boxes that they put the groceries in. Well, that is the absolute best bit. And I think it's to appeal to the large Japanese community in Sao Paulo, because they're all covered in just chrysanthemums. Very nice.
Oh, lovely, lovely. Yeah.
Well, the bakery looks pretty delicious to me. Yeah.
Well, it all looks really good. And I must say that all the pages in your special food section just make you want to eat. And I'm getting hungry. It's getting towards that time of day in London when one starts to think about food.
Let's go somewhere.
I think we've got Japanese coming in tonight for the late shift.
Very nice.
Lovely, yeah. Lovely.
Yes. Because we've
is this the late shift?
Sort of. This is the bridge shift.
Okay, I might have to do a little work
after.
We were
going to call your show The Bridge rather than Midori House, but then people get confused.
Santiago, thank you so much for being with us and telling us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Tyler.
Thank you.
Every month, the Monocle Shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afto en to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And next, we have Nick Kelly with some news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. World leaders voiced hope today that a major prisoner exchange between Israel and the Palestinians would help reinvigorate a peace process frozen for more than a year. But analysts said while the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas-ruled Gaza in return for 477 Palestinian detainees was celebrated on both sides, it did not address any core disputes that have bedeviled peace talks for 20 years. A suicide car bomb has exploded near two government ministries in Mogadishu, killing at least six people in the second such attack in the Somali capital this month. At least 19 people have been killed in clashes between Philippine troops and members of the largest Muslim rebel group. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Libya's capital Tripoli on an unannounced visit aimed at cementing a strong US-Libya partnership. A Milan judge today cleared Silvio Berlusconi in a fraud and embezzlement case related to his private broadcaster Mediaset, a rare legal victory for the weakened Italian Prime Minister, who is a defendant in three other trials. Homes close to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan are being decontaminated for the first time since it was hit by the earthquake and tsunami in March. Britain has signalled a drive to deepen ties with countries of the Maghreb, pledging help to tackle a growing threat from allies of Al-Qaeda in the region. Preliminary results from Cameroon's presidential election showed a widely expected landslide victory for incumbent Paul Biya, a member of the National Vote Counting Commission, told Reuters. And Ukraine's parliament today cancelled a plan to put the former Soviet Republic permanently on daylight saving time after widespread protests in the west of the country. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. Well, the bicycle is making a comeback. Not that it ever really went away. Sales are brisk, though. 20 million were sold in Europe alone last year. Among the most talked about two-wheelers is the so-called e-bike. It's not a moped. It's not a noped.
That's a new brand.
It's a noped.
I think
it's
that's great.
It's a noped because you've got your motor. It's an electric bike. I love it.
Yeah, they got it.
I'm now branding automatically. We head to Switzerland where Sabine Krippendorf, vice president of MTB Cycle Tech, is based. Tyler?
Hello, Frau Krippendorf.
Good evening.
Grüezi, how are you?
I'm very fine and happy to be with you.
Thank you for coming on. I was in Semmeritz over the summer. I had a knee operation, and so pedaling was actually one of the first things I was supposed to do when I was recovering, and it was actually quite depressing because then as I was sort of watching all these people go around the Engadine on their bicycles. At one point, I saw this. Woman of, I would probably say, maybe mid-80s or something, sort of just whizzed past up the hill. And she must have been on one of your bicycles. I believe it was probably at MTB. And I want to ask you, the growth that you're seeing in Switzerland in this movement, I mean, is this something which is, part of a government drive, or is this just pure good old entrepreneurialism?
Well, I think it's a lot of innovation and a lot of entrepreneurism and a lot of fun, too. And Switzerland seems to be one of the pioneer countries in this e-bike movement. And probably you were right. It was somebody on an e-bike. Maybe it was an MTB Cycle Tech or another one. and that she was part of one of the main target groups as a member of Generation 50 Plus, but there are others. There are also a lot of young people now.
She was definitely 80 plus. But anyway, it's good to know that 50-year-olds can
so
be included as well.
She was not an MTP cycle tech.
We spend a lot of time in Japan, and it's incredible if you look at the Japanese market, because I almost feel that every bike I see in Japan is somehow battery enabled. And are we a little bit behind, if we look at the European market and also the U.S. as well?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. Europe is really increasing rapidly now. We have Europe sold about 700,000 units last year, which is three times as much than it was in 2007. So it's really an increasing market, and probably this will go on like that for the next few years. The U.S. also is increasing a lot, but on a lower level. They have about 150,000 new e-bikes a year now. And the most increasing countries are Germany and Netherlands.
I wanted to ask you, do all cities, of course, well, every mayor likes bicycles, but do all mayors like e-bikes? I'm wondering if some governments and whether there's sort of legislation which is also anti-e-bike, because obviously there are still batteries included, there are still energy issues at the end of the day. But I'm wondering also if just some governments also think there are safety issues attached to them.
Well, that's two issues: safety and energy. It depends whether it's a good thing or not from an environmental point of view, is where the energy comes from, right? And also where the rider comes from. If he drove a car before and then changes on an e-bike, probably it's better energy-wise. But if he was riding a normal conventional bike before and then is changing and taking his e-bike, he's using more energy than he did before. And the safety issue, of course, that's, these things are really driving or riding very fast, so... Yeah, that's an issue. You have to be careful.
Can you go any faster on an e-bike than if you pedaled with all of your heart?
You do. That's why people do it. And everybody can do it. And this is the fun part about it. Everybody can be faster. You are faster when you have to get off a red light to go up a hill. It feels easy. You can go fast. You are almost as fast as the cars are in the city, so it's a lot of fun, of course.
So what's top speed?
You mean legally?
No, just no one's listening from the Zurich Stadtpolizei. So just tell us the real numbers.
Well, if you ride an e-bike without a registration number, then you shouldn't go. It will stop at 25 kilometers per hour.
Okay.
So that means it helps you to get off the red light, it helps you to get up the hill, and then you pedal.
Okay.
And then you go as fast as you can pedal.
Well, we're going to try to keep going as fast as we can here, because we only have a few minutes left on the program. But I must say, merci vielmals for that.
Merci vielmals to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. That was Sabine Krippendorf, VP at MTB Cycletech. Do you need one of those down in Wales, Nancy?
I would like that, because it's very hilly.
Yeah.
And I'm on a very narrow single-track road.
No, I think this is where
dandy.
They
but
do
I have
come...
a quad bike that I go around.
Oh, do you?
With. Yes.
A quad bike?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I do. It's a four-wheeler, but they call them bikes.
But not a no, it's not a bicycle with four
wheels.
No, it's a
okay. Red farm vehicle, and I can take my lavender creams around.
I think we could set an obstacle course for you. And
yes.
Guess what happens now in the program?
Well, I was going to say that people are listening to Monocle 24.
You could do that.
Because they are. This is Midori House. I'm Nancy Durham. You're Tyler Brulé. And then...
I have a little treat for you. I think I know your musical taste, but I'm actually going to take you somewhere else right now.
Okay.
We're going to... This is something I discovered in Kyoto. This is someone who's much loved in Japan. His name is Noriyuki Makihara. It's a very up song. It's called Firefly. I know, Nancy, you're like funking out over here. That
I
was
love
Noriyuki
it.
Makihara. I was still into it because they've caught it. The big number was coming up.
Oh.
I know. It's
well,
all right.
We'll do that the next time.
We'll listen to
it
at my office afterwards.
I love it. And I love the high notes.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
It's happy,
yeah,
sexy music to
and
me.
And we're happy to have you back.
Oh, thank you very
it's
much.
It's very, very nice, because we all know that branding is basic, and some products and places are naturally more challenging than others. You can say that again. Take all those troubled and malign countries that end with Stan. Sacha Baron Cohen's Borat put Kazakhstan on the map, for better or for worse. And what about the other Stans? Can you even name them out there in the giant sprawling emerging market that is Central Asia? Well, Nancy was in Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan, to investigate how the Kyrgyz people might brand their nation.
I think we actually are located in the center of Bishkek. Pretty nice. I mean, I would say it's a pretty green place.
Yeah, very leafy, lots of parks.
We can see a park, Dubovy Park. It's like oak park, oak.
Oak trees. Stanislav Karpovich, Staz, not Stan for short, is a high-flying Bishkek business consultant. He's taking me for a spin in his 1995 Mercedes, showing me some of the new and the old Bishkek.
Let me turn around and we can see the Lenin over there.
That's one of those famous classic Lenin poses.
Still exists.
Where's he pointing? He's pointing to Moscow or?
Well, no, I mean, someplace? Just the way, I mean, to the better future, and that's it.
The Kyrgyz people did live better when the Russians ruled, and that fact has helped to keep them friends since independence. So all those compulsory statues of Lenin that dot the former USSR are mostly still in place here, even as the country transforms to a democracy.
And now we can see on the right side, now we can see the parliament. We called it White House. Previously it was the, the governmental building, but now it's a parliament, because now we live in a parliamentary republic.
Why do you laugh?
Yeah, that's fun, because we just started. It's not easy. It's not simple. It's not simple at all. It's very hard process. We are surviving so far after two revolutions. We are surviving. So we'll see.
And post-revolutionary politics is thriving. Take the presidential election underway right now. At the start of the campaign, there were 78 candidates for the job. The Kyrgyz people enthusiastically embrace capitalism. Here in Sum, Bishkek's incessantly busy main department store, you can find almost anything, from the country's popular felt slippers to the latest in home entertainment.
It's in English also, with English and Russian subtitles. You can change the language. Let's show you. This one is it's Melancholia.
Melancholia, yeah.
Yeah, Bridesmaids, Jane Eyre in new version, Drive, for example, The Tree of the Life with Brad Pitt and Sean Penn, and many, many others.
The sales girl flips through her stock of new release DVDs, $4 a flick, thanks to Kyrgyzstan's closest and strongest trading partner, Russia.
We make order in Moscow, and after 2 weeks we have already here in good quality the DVDs, and I think it's not so difficult.
It's legal? Is it legal?
Yeah, it's legal. This one, it's illegal, but you know...
She's under the impression her Moscow-copied movies are legal when there's only one film per disc. More than that, and she's not sure. You're famous for getting cheap movies. You can buy movies cheaply here.
Yeah.
But that's not a way to sell your country, is it?
Yeah, it's not Yeah, maybe it's not all the legal, right? You're right. But, we have a good quality. I think many people want to buy these movies because it's cheap and have good quality.
You meet tourists all the time and visitors to Kyrgyzstan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to ask you, how would you sell Kyrgyzstan to the outside world? What brand would you put on
how,
it?
How can I brand it?
You know, England has the royal family, Canada has skiing and lots of lakes and forests, and the Americans have New York, the Big Apple, and you have Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, we have the beautiful mountains, we have a beautiful lake, the name of the Issyk-Kul, you know?
Issyk-Kul Lake, the mountain lake?
Yeah, mountain lake, and it's very, very clean and beautiful place.
Kyrgyzstan can rightly brand itself as a stunning destination, but I had to wonder what Staz would make of the sales pitch for illegal DVDs. I find it fascinating that up on the third floor, I think it is, of your biggest department store,
yeah,
there are women up there selling illegal DVDs. Fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, because we have a very tiny market, and you know, nobody wants to deal with that. I mean, probably yes, there are organizations, there officially yes, but well, this is the bad part about being the relatively poor, and you know,
you want to sell.
This is not the selling point. Slippers, the selling point. Yeah, this is the selling point of the country: tourism, mountains, lake, slippers.
Slippers? I own a pair of the famed Kyrgyz felt slippers. I love them. But build a national brand on slippers?
We will sell our slippers worldwide. Yeah, we need to conquer the market. We need to conquer the world. I think this is the real, this real unique good product, I mean, which we are really proud of.
How could you brand your country with a slipper?
It's unique. It's stylish. It's different, it's warm, and it's necessary.
In an airy workshop at the Tumar factory in downtown Bishkek, women stand at a slatted worktop the size of a ping pong table, each one working a large blob of slipper-shaped felted wool. Each slipper is soaking wet and bundled up in a silk scarf. The parcels are rolled back and forth, one step in the two-day process it takes to make a pair. The blobs, beginning to look more like slippers, are next moved on to the men, whose strength is needed to brush them back and forth against another set of slats, smoothing the bottoms flat. Then each slipper is hammered into shape, stretched, prodded and pulled into its final size. This is part of the art of felting, and the Kyrgyz are world leaders at it. They know wool. Historically, they lived in yurts, raised sheep, spun yarn. The owners of this slipper factory have helped to turn the soft, rounded felt slipper into an essential item for the discerning Bishkek visitor. Once you own a pair, there's no going back. I want some more. And I love this gray pattern with green polka dots. Can I buy a pair here for me?
For you, I see.
I bagged a new pair of the gray and greens at the Tumar retail shop later in the week for $22, a bargain for something so carefully crafted. Quality products come from the remotest corners of Kyrgyzstan too, where aid agencies are working to develop skills. According to Stas, it's life-saving.
For real, poor families, that would be the only source of income. And it's great, it's nice, and now they have a product and they can feed their families, and it's perfect, it's great, it's a good project. We need to find what our added value to the global market, and I think we found it, it's a part of it.
And that is?
And that is slippers!
I rounded off my week in Bishkek at an open-air craft fair where yards of colored silk and plenty of felt were on display, woven into dresses, scarves, and jackets. Linara Yarolina is an economist turned yoga instructor with an eye for fashion. She says felt ought to be a hit in London, New York, and Tokyo.
Of course. Because it's a very good material. It looks fantastic. It's very beautiful. And at the same time, it's ecological. Yes, and it looks very original. You cannot find it anywhere else. It looks very nice. And you will be very fashionable if you will decorate your style with a scarf made of felt or small flower made of felt, anything.
What about slippers? I know a man who thinks Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, can brand itself with the slipper, the felt slipper.
Yes, I also think so. It's a good idea.
For M24, I'm Nancy Durham in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
That was our Nancy Durham, who's also hosting this program. Nice gig you have.
Oh. And, Tyler, take your shoes off. Take them off.
Oh, my goodness.
I think I'm one of these pairs. Are they cool?
These?
Describe.
I will describe them. So they're sort of like baked potatoes. Do they look like a baked potato that you actually sort of cut the back off?
Yeah, like a nice one, not warty.
No, not a warty baked potato. These are very thought through. Tumar, Kyrgyzstan. I can see that they have some rubber no slip. I mean, these are quite advanced, actually.
But nicely done. Like, they're not gross feeling.
These are very nice done. So it's a very, very thick felt.
And it's a gorgeous gray.
It's
a kind of monochrome gray, if you ask me.
It is, with large blue polka dots and sort of a royal blue. And then we've got orange as well.
And I have green ones at home, and I couldn't get the green dots for you in your size because I sort of thought we should have matching slippers.
It's true. But you know what? I think we probably could have saved a good 50 or 60,000 on building these studios and not gone for all of the soundproofing. We just could have put everyone in slippers when they come in, right?
And slippers and felt on the walls.
It just would have been the trip to Kyrgyzstan and back.
Would you take a shoe off? We've got minutes to go.
I've got them off.
Yeah, I'm dying to know.
We need a set of scissors because look, they're bound. Well, no, I'll just
do it.
The only problem is they're sort of bound. I can walk geisha style because they're bound together.
I was told
they
this
fit
would
perfectly.
Be.
They do.
I'm so excited. Let me see.
I'm going to swing around.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tyler. Tyler, I've got Tyler Brûlé in slippers from Kyrgyzstan. I would say that Kyrgyzstan is now branded.
Yeah, it is.
You know, if Brûlé's wearing them.
But if they're saying, they're talking about lakes, mountains, and slippers, I think that's good. I would add yurts to that
Does anyone have a knife or scissors? Because then I want you to keep them on.
You could cut me free.
Because you've been working really hard and you can walk around. Anyone?
I will.
Knife? Scissors?
What about yurts as well?
I don't have a yurt for you, but you've reminded me I do have something else for you.
Okay.
I'm just gonna
sit here with my feet bound together.
And maybe when this, I've also brought home a tune for you from Kyrgyzstan.
Okay.
It's called Karacha Torgoy, which means dark-haired sparrow. Maybe it was dark-feathered sparrow. It is a folk melody which has been reworked by a young musician, a lovely man I met there called Murat Koldyshev. He's in charge of sound at the American University of Central Asia, a fine place. And the instrument you're going to hear in this is a very famous one. It's called a komuz, and it's a small one-stringed instrument, and that's sort of the main thing happening in there. Let's hear a bit of that, and while we're listening, we'll get some scissors.
Mm.
Okay, that piece of music, helped along by Murat Koldyshev. It's Karacha Torgoy, all the way from Kyrgyzstan.
It was beautiful. I thought there was going to be lyrics, though.
I know, I did too, but there aren't.
I know.
I'll ask Murat to send lyrics next time.
Because I'm actually hearing in my headphones from our lawyer. They want to know if that's actually legal, that
music.
Yeah,
I have permission.
It's cleared.
Permission, it's cleared. And
did you come back with a lot of DVDs as well?
No, I didn't.
All shot off a shaky cam in the back of a Moscow cinema.
I did not buy a DVD.
And here's my biggest question.
Quick
question. My biggest question. How did you fly by Istanbul? Did you fly in Turkish? Or how did you get there?
No, I flew British Midlands International. Mm-hmm. We stopped on the way. We went to Almaty, which is the capital of Kazakhstan. Didn't see Borat because we just stayed on the plane.
I've been to Almaty.
Yeah, it's...
With Jillian.
Oh.
Our producer today.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, we can talk about that another time.
So you fly all night and you get there, you just stay on the plane for, I don't know, an hour or something, and then 40 minutes later, you're even less, you're in Bishkek. Coming back, you stop in Baku.
Okay.
And it's a long flight altogether, 8 hours, 9 hours with stopping, but it isn't that bad.
That's a good segue for tonight's show. Did you know that?
What, Baku. It isn't that bad?
No, not that. No, Baku, because we have the British ambassador, the Azerbaijani ambassador to the UK is on our program tonight. Because you've actually started a whole theme for us, which is looking at not just branding stands, but really the whole Central Asian world.
Well, it's exciting. And all jokes aside, I think the slippers, that they're really onto something. No. And if you were just talking during your music too, you know, the 22... bucks for a pair of these. The labor that goes into
it. They saw you coming.
Unbelievable.
They saw you coming. They're probably about 15 bucks, right? You
can
probably get them.
You can buy these for $5. Mm. But the quality of this particular slipper, you notice I'm not setting them on the table because my mom says that's
very bad,
bad luck.
Yeah.
You have that too?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we've got to be really careful about that. But anyway, I'm thrilled that they fit you.
No, I think they're great. The other thing I was going to say as well, look at Brazil. Look what the Havaianas flip-flop has done for Brazil. I mean, you ask people to think about something which comes from Brazil, a Brazilian brand, people think of the flip-flop, the rubber Havaianas, and this could do the same for a Central Asian republic.
Yeah, very exciting.
Good. I say that in all seriousness.
I think that you are telling me this very seriously.
Absolutely.
And I'm taking it that way.
Very good. Do you have the contacts for them?
I have, of course.
You never know.
Yeah, of course I've got them. But what I, without sort of over, you know, hammering these things to death, it's almost like they designed them with the monocle kind of theme in mind?
Maybe.
That subdued gray, brown, beige.
I think Nick Kelly must have a pair as well, because he came in so silently, didn't he?
Well,
I'm
Nick,
just trying to get this into the news bulletin, actually. Nick, I think it could be breaking news.
Aren't they lovely?
They're
have
absolutely
a feel.
Wonderful,
don't
yeah.
put them on the table, though.
I'm not. Just hold them right, away from the table. Good. I'm so interested that you have that same thing about the table. You know, we're just counting down now. The seconds until this we say goodbye after
we say goodbye,
our
but we'll
first show together.
Yes, and we'll probably see you tomorrow as well, no?
I will be here tomorrow and very much looking forward to being here. It's been fantastic having you in the studio, and now it's time for me to say the news with Nick Kelly.